We have panel three, representatives of the natural gas industry, and going first will be Mr. Paul Robb from Energy Tools LLC. Proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. As I was introduced, my name is Paul Robb. I'm an independent economic consultant appearing on behalf of the Energy Association of Pennsylvania.
Could you please pull the microphone a little bit closer?
Closer still? Okay. I've been providing consulting services for over 30 years to the utility industry. Probably a primary interest in this docket is I was one of those individuals responsible for Washington Gas DSM programs, such as you're contemplating in Pennsylvania. We worked on those programs and implemented those and had budgets in the millions of dollars throughout the 90s. So I know the difficult task it is to move from a theoretical construct of what you'd like to achieve with respect to your DSM programs to actually achieving results. Of interest to this proceeding, I've been working on similar issues in Kansas, Maryland, Oklahoma, and Virginia. In Maryland, many of you are probably aware of the Empower Maryland legislation, where the electric utilities are under obligation to reduce load similar to what your legislation is in Pennsylvania. And in Kansas, we have similar legislation, not really with respect to targets, but with respect to the electric utilities offering programs. Kansas did something very interesting that I would just ask you to take a look at. Kansas, because of the topics that I'm going to be talking about today, Kansas implemented a specific docket to examine fuel switching and how the direct use of natural gas at the end use level could produce energy efficiency benefits in the state. And I would encourage you, that proceeding is underway now, comments are being filed, and it's very interesting to see how that is progressing. With all that, let me, and I will be brief this morning, I just want to provide you with our primary message and secondary messages that we'd like the Commission to take away from my presentation. The primary message is that the direct use of natural gas at the end use level has the potential to contribute significantly to electricity reduction goals and reduce natural gas usage, and thereby enhancing overall energy efficiency in the Commonwealth. I'll show you some reasons why this works. I'm sure my colleague, Mr. Edelstein, will provide you some information as well. But as one commissioner framed natural gas substitution for electricity at the end use level, it really is a win-win situation. And I would hate to see Pennsylvania embark on a program of aggressive programs that did not include some natural gas fuel switching at the end use level. With respect to our secondary messages, the first one I think is particularly important here, and that is that electric DSM programs are relevant to the NGDCs because payments to incent electricity efficiency will influence the fuel selection decision and can result in increased usage of electricity in conflict with electricity reduction goals. I'll go briefly through why that happens. Let me just say that in Maryland, what we found was with respect to programs, for example, that incented customers to install high-efficiency HVAC equipment, it only took 4% of those customers who took advantage of the incentive to install a heat pump relative to an air conditioner, and the entire benefits of the HVAC program were wiped out. That is, all of the savings that would be achieved through more efficient usage of appliances was wiped out because of fuel switching from natural gas to electricity. And then finally, and I won't go through these in any detail, but at the back of our presentation you see a set of policies that we think the Commission should consider for adoption as it considers whether it's going to go through the process or how it's going to go through the process of implementing DSM programs in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We've offered up these policies in a number of other jurisdictions, some of which I already mentioned. I think they have been at least implicitly recognized and implicitly embraced, and I think they've assisted the commissions in those jurisdictions to implement DSM programs as they go forward.
You have 30 seconds.
With that, I will conclude my presentation and defer to your questions. We did file a document with you, and that has a lot of information. It has a lot of references that I would encourage you to take a look at as you consider this process, and we are certainly happy to answer questions, and I am certainly available offline after this proceeding to provide you any of the documentation that is indicated in the presentation. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Edelstein, and thank you very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Edelstein from the Gas Technology Institute. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, and public. In Pennsylvania, it's a pleasure to be here today. I have 31 years of experience in the energy industry, about 25 with Gas Research Institute and Gas Technology Institute, and I want to share a few things with you. There was a discussion today about consumer-driven electricity, and what I would urge is that even a broader definition, consumer-driven energy, and let's allow the consumers in Pennsylvania to make choice of fuels for their use, especially traditional applications that require thermal energy, such as heating and water heating and space heating in homes and in offices. Next page, please. Basic message is, if you start off with a unit of coal, a BTU of coal in the coal mine, by the time you get it to the end-use site, you end up with somewhere between a quarter and 40% of that energy actually delivered to the meter. Even in combined cycle natural gas plants, you end up with somewhere between a third and half the energy delivered to the home. For BTU delivered to the meter, you get about 91% of the energy delivered to the home. Of course, still has to go through the appliance. And so does it make a lot of sense to take the thermal energy, put it into the power plant, transmit it through the transmission and electric transmission distribution system, get it to the house, then turn it back into thermal energy. So from an overall fuel cycle standpoint, it makes a lot more sense to use thermal energy. If you're going to use thermal energy in the home or the office, use it directly and don't go through a number of conversion processes. Next slide. Just point out there's about, according to Bureau of Census, about 861,000 electrically heated residences in Pennsylvania. Next slide. If you go back to primary energy use again, natural gas, fully condensing furnace, you're dealing with about 48 million BTUs is burned in the home. If you go through the full fuel cycle and the efficiency of the appliance, which is about 96%, about 56 million BTUs for natural gas, fully condensing furnace on the right, fully condensing propane, high efficiency electric heat pump, not too bad. But you look at electric resistance heating, supposedly 100% efficient in the house now, look using site energy, you're talking about 160 million BTUs of coal or natural gas or renewables used to generate that energy. So not the best way to use energy on a full fuel cycle basis. Next slide, although CO2 is not within the current conservation considerations, I want to remind you that it's coming around the bend. At NARUC, the chairman of FERC, who's not necessarily the same party as the president, did point out that probably by 2010 there will be some, but probably not before then, there will be some greenhouse gas legislation. He believes fully condensing gas furnace on the order of 3 tons of CO2 per year per household. For electric resistance heating, you're talking on the order of 9 or 10 tons of CO2 per household. So just to mention that as well. If we can go down a couple of slides here. Electric water heaters, there's at least probably a million and a quarter electric water heaters in Pennsylvania. 100% efficiency on site, you're talking about approximately 3,200 kilowatt hours per year per home. If you can displace that, you can remove 3.9 million megawatt hours from the electric mix today. So major advantage there. Next slide, please. If you look at combined electric water heating and space heating again is in the 600,000 to 800,000 range, and assume all the space heating in Pennsylvania is electric heat pumps, which it's not. Some is electric resistance heating. You're talking about 8.5 million megawatt hours of of savings. Total residential use in Pennsylvania, according to EPA, is about 52 million. 16.5% of residential electricity use can be saved between electric water heater substitution and electric heating substitution with natural gas. So next slide. Just some examples, condensing gas water heaters available. These are the tankless units, over 90% efficient. There's also a 90% efficient tank-based water heater. And of course, gas furnaces, 90% efficient, have been available on the market since the early 80s.
Next slide. 30 seconds.
Next slide, please. Okay, so, you know, basic questions come up. Won't this increase natural gas use? And the answer is yes, but it will offset the need to build new electric generation facilities. And what will those new electric generation facilities be? I submit that in the near term, there will probably be natural gas or renewables, and so it will displace natural gas use. And, of course, this can be set by aggressive energy efficiency programs within the natural gas industry to displace less efficient natural gas equipment in homes and offices. And what about the gas cost of a gas hookup in a home that doesn't have it? You certainly have to take that into account in a total resource test type of analysis when you're looking at hooking up a house to gas, because that cost is not negligible. You need to look at that as well. Last slide. So we urge looking at a full fuel cycle view of energy opportunities, energy efficiency opportunities, including direct gas use. Let's offer the customers the full choice of gas or electric options here, and major savings available in kilowatt hour usage from either substitution of electric resistance heating or space heating, water heating, or even substitution for electric heat pumps. Thank you.
Now, questions, starting with Vice Chairman Christie.
I don't have any questions.
Commissioner Pallison.
Thank you. Mr. Robb, just a quick question for you. In your testimony, you noted you've been working on similar issues both in Maryland and Virginia and Kansas, I understand, with this fuel switching concept. Looking south of the Mason-Dixon border, give us your experience, what the state of Maryland and Virginia are doing on this front.
Well, Virginia sort of runs in fits and starts, but I think they're probably more in a fits position now than a start position. They have some legislation. The commission is not what I would characterize as fully on board with energy efficiency, primarily due to equity reasons that you'll get into as you deal with the rate impact measure test. So Maryland is much farther along in this process, and Maryland has some fairly broad targets to meet. I believe their targets are 15% by the year 2015, 15 by 15, and then an additional 5% of that, so they're 20% by 2020. So they have to do something. All of the utilities have been before the commission at this point, and that includes PEPCO, SMECO, Allegheny, and BG&E, and they've all been before the commission at this point with their brand of best practice, in quotes, conservation programs. The commission has, for the last 2 years, continued to reject those programs. I think their concerns are that they're more of the same. They're more of the same old with respect to energy efficiency, even though they're touted as some of the best in the country. And so I think what's happening is my client in that particular circumstance is Washington Gas, and Washington Gas has been advocating for programs such as I've talked about briefly here today and that are talked about in my testimony in greater lengths, because the benefits are so much greater. You get, for example, a total resource cost test benefit that's higher than any electric program you're going to have. You level the playing field. There has the potential for these programs to actually reduce natural gas prices, even though you're burning more of it at the end use level, because you're burning less of it to generate electricity. So I think the answer, I wish I could say they'd endorsed programs and they were going full speed ahead, but I think where they're at now is they've not endorsed any of the electric programs, and if I could have some wishful thinking, I would think that they are looking very hard at approving some type of pilot program, at least in the very short term, or at least studying this in its own docket to determine whether this may be the best way to achieve electricity reductions and overall energy usage reductions in the state of Maryland.
We often run into that issue, too, of addressing things like real-time pricing models, so I appreciate your input.
Yes.
I'd also be remiss, I know the Maryland Commission, we should recognize in the audience today their former chairman, Ken Schistler, is with us, so appreciate his involvement here. One last question. You brought this issue of equity reasons up. You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I'm sure if you haven't gotten into it yet, you'll get into it when you start discussing what's going to be cost-effective. How are we going to determine what a cost-effective test is, or a cost-effective program is? My experience around the country has been that you look around. If you're starting this process, you look around and basically you settle on the California Standard Practice Manual. California Standard Practice Manual has four or five tests. The primary one, total resource cost test, we talked about that a little bit this morning with the prior panel. There's a program administrator cost test and a participants cost test. You know, those three tests are relatively easy for a conservation program to pass. The fourth test, and the one that's more difficult to pass, is the rate impact measure test. And the rate impact measure test is designed to measure what the rate consequences will be of charging non-participating customers for the incentive and program costs of these programs, as well as, if you get this far, lost margins with respect to those programs. So Virginia, for example, looks at it as simply a transfer payment of transferring dollars from non-participating customers to participating customers. Given the small scale of many of these programs, that has become an issue for them. They are concerned, and I was involved in a case for Virginia Natural just a couple of weeks ago. Their program started off with less than 4% of the customers participating, which meant that, and they were quick to point out, 96% of the customers were paying that cost of those 4% participating. Now, what that does, and I'm sympathetic to a lot of those arguments, as I'm sure many of the electric utilities are, and perhaps even the consumer advocate is. And that, I believe, is the beauty of the direct substitution of natural gas for electricity at the end-use level. It has the potential to actually have positive RIM results. That is, it will reduce the rates of electric customers, and it will reduce rates for natural gas customers. The reasons are explained in my testimony, but essentially they go to the relationship between the average embedded cost of the utilities and the avoided cost of the utilities. So that's when I explained that to the Maryland Commission, that's when they coined this phrase that it was really a win-win. They said these programs appear to be win-win, and the answer is yes, they do.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Commissioner Pittman-Grilly.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming. You ran out of time in your remarks to go over your recommended policies. Aside from the total resource cost, are there any other policy recommendations you want to highlight for us?
I think it would probably take me another half hour or so to do that, so I won't. But let me just say that we most of those recommended policies try to capture in one way, shape, or form the three primary messages that we were trying to provide. That is that natural gas fuel switching at the end-use level can be a beneficial DSM program for electric utilities. So whatever policy you establish should encourage or at least recognize that is an option in the overall cost-effectiveness evaluation of the programs. The second primary message, or the secondary message, about the impact that these programs have that electric programs can have on the consumption of natural gas and therefore increase electricity consumption is another group within those policy prescriptions. And I think that's very important, and it's more of a subtle problem as you're implementing implementing programs like this, because you think, well, we'll go out and we'll spend some dollars and we'll encourage customers to put in high efficiency equipment, and then to top that all off, you say, okay, and we're going to assume deemed savings for many of these measures so that we don't have to go back and look and see what really happened, that is, whether customers substituted out an air conditioner for a heat pump and reduced gas load and actually increased electricity load. So the other broad group of recommendations go to that second primary message, that you really have to be very careful when evaluating DSM programs for electricity, because they aren't in all cases, and in most cases, and certainly in no case where there is fuel competition at the end-use level, they are not fuel neutral. So we could probably bring all of those policy recommendations together to make those two primary points.
Well, thank you both for coming and discussing the benefits of natural gas. I just have one question for Mr. Edelstein. You talked about a couple of the issues that would be associated with it. Can you talk a little bit more about the issue relating to the cost gas hookup?
Yes, there's a couple different issues. One, there are houses that are on gas mains but don't have gas services to them. That is, let's say, all electric houses or houses with oil heat or oil hot water. Obviously, those would be the ones that I would consider first, because then you don't have to extend the main, simply extend the service. The other issue, of course, is the... So you have the service line issue, which, depending on the length of service line, might be $1,000 to hook the system up to the... depending on local costs and what the soil condition is, very variable, whether it's concrete or pavement or asphalt. Second issue is the main extension if you don't have mains on the street. Third issue, of course, is if you have an all-electric house, if you have electric resistance heating, you don't have a vent system. If you have an electric heat pump or an electric warm air furnace, which has an electric resistance unit in it, then you actually have a duct system. So the substitution of piece of gas equipment is relatively easy. You do have to run the interior piping for the gas system, and you do have to put in a vent system for the natural gas equipment as well. So that would be additional costs. Those kinds of things can be handled with DSM dollars as part of the encouragement to use the most energy efficient equipment possible. So that needs to be added in addition to the cost of the appliance itself.
And consumers that want to explore that option, where do you usually recommend they start?
I would say they can call their HVAC people, they can call their local gas company, but I would start with the gas company, especially if gas is not available within their house itself. And then I would encourage the commission. There are usually some kind of protocols or rules for extending gas service or gas mains to new houses. Maybe it's, you know, a certain return on equity, or it's a certain 100 feet of mains or 100 feet of services. If that could be relaxed a little bit, then encouragement of new hookups would make a big difference. And then, in fact, the customers could really choose what type of fuel that they wanted to use, and actually pick the most energy efficient equipment and the lowest cost from a utility bill standpoint equipment to use.
Do you feel our regulations and policies in Pennsylvania accommodate that now, or do you feel we need to take another look at them?
Well, I would say it's always worth another look to make sure that I don't know your policies in detail, but I would say it's always worth another look to make sure that the ability to hook up to the various energy sources is available there. There's a lot of incentives issues, split incentives issues between renters and owners, and between home builders and our home builders incentivized, let's say, to go all electric, for instance, where that may not be the best policy for their consumers, the people that are actually in the buildings. So those things need to be looked at. But specifically, I don't know the details of your policies here.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you. And thank you both for coming. And we amongst the commissioners had made a promise that we were going to limit our questions so that we can get through this day efficiently, but sometimes we aren't able to limit our questions, and this is one of them. Have either of you met with Pennsylvania gas supply company, retail supply companies, and discussed this with Pennsylvania companies?
I have not.
I have not specifically met with them, although obviously my client is their association and has reviewed the testimony that I've provided.
The reason for my question is you know, it is actually rather compelling to take this in consideration, and my initial reaction to your testimony is that it could, I would challenge the assumption that fuel switching could be a energy efficiency and conservation tool. But in listening to your testimony and reading it a little better, I have reason to believe that we should investigate it further. I would encourage you both to reach out to my office, and maybe we can facilitate some dialogue between Pennsylvania natural gas suppliers just to see how credible a fuel switching option could be in pursuit of our conservation goals.
I'd be happy to do that, Your Honor.
And so would I. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we are very fortunate to have both of you with us this morning. I know both of you have had vast experience with these issues, and it's a great benefit to us to learn from you because of what you're doing in other states as well. We have the benefit also of having the Pennsylvania Cable Network broadcasting this program. You have necessarily given us technical information in your prepared statements, but to continue what Commissioner Putzengrilli was doing, here's your chance to educate tens of thousands of people in Pennsylvania about the practical steps that they can take advantage of what you are advocating. And just for starters, let me clarify. I believe you are here, at least Mr. Robb, you are here on behalf of the Pennsylvania Energy Association, which is comprised of both electric companies and gas companies. And what you have said is that it is a benefit to both electric companies and gas companies for certain customers to switch their fuel from electricity to gas. So if you're here on behalf of the association, which has both kinds of companies, it's rather notable that you would make that recommendation. But here's your chance. Rather than speaking necessarily to us in technical terms so that we can implement this act, what's a step-by-step practical approach? What kind of advice would you give to people if they're going to take your advice?
Well, I think there are a couple of parties that I would recommend something different for sort of each of them. Let's assume that our primary message is to the Commission this morning, because it's my understanding that you're going to define the broad framework under which DSM is going to be implemented in Pennsylvania. And in order to do that, I believe, and in order to avail yourselves of our recommendations, I think that you must, should, I would respectfully recommend that you do incorporate or in your program designs allow for the incorporation of these types of fuel switching programs. And then, you know, that I think is the message that we would send to the Commission. To the electric utilities, who quite often are reluctant to implement programs that actually reduce their load, I would recommend that they look at these types of programs and do an unbiased cost-benefit evaluation using whatever cost-benefit framework you, the Commission, land upon when they're to implement these programs. And I think that when they do that, they will find that these types of programs not only save more electricity than many other programs that they could do, but do so more cost-effectively. So I think that what the message I would say to them is, do not rule out these types of programs because you have some philosophical difference or have some philosophical problem with promoting an alternative fuel to meet a portion of your load. The third group that I would talk to is the natural gas utilities. As Mr. Edelstein pointed out, in order to do these cost-benefit analyses, they're going to need a lot of more information from the gas utilities on avoided costs, on costs of hookups, on line extension policies, and so on and so forth. We've dealt with these issues in Maryland relatively well by providing, and we being the gas utilities in that case, by providing the electric utilities all of this information and allowing them to do their own cost-benefit evaluation as we started. So I think those are the three primary parties that have to get involved at this point. Now, when these programs hit the street, in the vernacular, I think it's important that then that both the electric and the gas utilities go out to consumers. I think that it is important for those consumers to be identified as likely candidates for this type of program, that is, those customers for whom the line extension will be not a very significant expense, and who are perhaps high-usage customers of electricity. Maryland has even suggested that perhaps this is a perfect program for low-income consumers because they have such trouble paying their bills, and the switch to natural gas is one that really benefits them dramatically by lowering their bills. So I realize I've been rambling a little bit, but I think all of those four parties have to be involved in this process. I think they have to cooperate. I don't think they will cooperate willingly without the Commission's guidance, and so I would recommend you do that. But other than that, I really think this is no different than any other DSM program, and it should not be considered any different than any other DSM or efficiency program that you would implement in Pennsylvania. And to the extent that it's marketed well, and to the extent that customers like the type of program, then I would recommend that it be implemented. We certainly wouldn't want to force it on anybody if they didn't like it.
All right, now that's very helpful. Now, give it to me from the customer's viewpoint, who's sitting in an all-electric home. Let's assume he's reachable by a main extension from a gas company. Ron?
I would say to the electric customers, if you have electric-resistant heating, and how do you find that out? Well, if you've got little baseboard units with radiators around your house, or if your warm air furnace is not an electric heat pump and there's electric resistance elements in there, you're probably using 10,000 kilowatt hours a year to heat your house. Run out and talk to your local gas company. If you don't have a gas line and you can't get one, talk to your propane company. You're spending an awful lot of money. If you have an older house built in the 50s or 60s, put insulation in, have a community action group work with you if you're a low-income customer and you need to work there, and consider switching to natural gas or switching to propane. If you have oil heat and you thought oil prices are going to come down and stay down, they're not going to, consider switching that too. Look at high-efficiency furnaces. They've been on the market for decades. They work. They're easy. If you have electric-resistance water heater, take a look at that. Consider switching to the highest natural gas water heater you can. Some of the compact ones are expensive. Talk to your gas company about hooking you up. If you can't do that, think about propane. Look at your energy bill. Look at the first cost of hooking you up. Look for assistance from the weatherization assistance programs if you need those. There are ways to get your energy bills down, and you should take advantage of those if you can.
Excellent. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Next, we will have the panel four, the electric suppliers, and we'll start with Mr. Hudson from the Retail Energy Supply Association.
Thank you. Is this on? Anyway, good morning, Chairman, Vice Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Richie Hudson. I'm with the Retail Energy Supply Association.
You're going to have to pull the microphone a little closer. Thank you. Okay, thanks.
I also work directly for Reliant Energy, which is a member of RESA, and my colleague here today, Chris Callaher, represents Direct Energy, which is also a RESA member. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present our views today on how to make sure that the Commonwealth as a whole and individual consumers benefit from the greater availability of alternative energy conservation, efficiency, and demand response products and services. If you stop and think about it, the way that we buy electricity today is really kind of shocking. It's sort of like going to a supermarket where there are no prices posted, filling up your cart, taking it to the checkout line, checking out, then getting home and receiving a bill for your groceries a month later. Because today, in the electric industry, customers don't experience any meaningful price signals and really have little incentive to use less electricity when it's cheaper to produce. So what's needed today is a dramatic paradigm shift in the way customers think about and purchase electricity. RESA fully supports policies that encourage conservation and efficiency, but it's critically important to keep the customer really at the center of this discussion. We look forward to working with the Commission and other parties to implement Act 129. But the Commission should pursue policies that put customers in the driver's seat and allow them to best determine the actions that they're willing to take to reduce demand, reduce consumption, and change their energy buying decisions. This can be done in two primary ways. First, by continuing to encourage the development of a competitive retail market, which will bring a vast array of new products and services that will help customers change the way they consume and purchase electricity. And second, by seeking to fully tap into the power of the competitive marketplace in meeting the specific consumption and demand reduction requirements stipulated in Act 129. On the first point, I'd like to take a minute just to point out a recent study published by the Alliance for Retail Choice. This study examines in detail how retail competition has led directly to innovative products and services such as green and clean electricity products that allow customers to invest in renewable energy or to mitigate the harmful impact of their carbon footprint. New pricing options and demand response products that give customers a financial incentive to reduce peak demand, and other value-added services such as energy efficiency audits and total energy management solutions. Attached to my testimony are excerpts from this report that show the entire range of products and services that are now available as a result of competition and a list of the retailers that are providing these services, which includes several recent members. So it's really clear that competition and choice have been and will continue to be the critical catalysts that are needed for this paradigm shift that's needed to transform today's electric industry. So it's vitally important that as the Commission considers other policies such as default service procurement and pricing plans, that these policies be designed to promote sustainable and vibrant competitive retail markets that will serve as a platform for delivering innovative services and new energy products that will advance the public policy goal of smarter and more efficient energy use. Specifically with respect to the implementation of Act 129, RESA believes that the Commission should try to foster innovation by allowing for programs that really go beyond traditional and physical efficiency measures like weatherization or appliance upgrades. As an example of the type of innovative program that could be possible in the near future, Reliant is currently working with market participants in the Texas marketplace to implement a smart energy program. Attached to my testimony on page 11 is a diagram that will show you how such a program could work. But basically, the type of program would utilize smart metering and smart grid technology to provide customers with up-to-date information on usage and projected electricity spend and real-time pricing. This information would be available to customers through a variety of media, including an in-home display device, through the internet, and through mobile devices such as a cell phone or a BlackBerry. These tools would be given to the customers, and they would be able to take action to reduce their energy usage and total monthly spend. This type of program would serve as a platform for total customization matched directly to the customer's individual comfort level and willingness to take action. And in that regard, it has the potential to be far more valuable than any single type of energy efficiency measure.
You have 30 seconds.
For example, a customer could get a text message with their monthly bill, once their monthly bill hits a certain amount, they could program their system to change the thermostat when prices reach a certain level, and they could check real-time prices on a display screen in their kitchen to decide whether it would be cheaper to run the dishwasher at 3 p.m. or right before going to bed. I address a lot of other issues with respect to Act 129 implementation in my testimony, but I do want to highlight one point, and that's the importance that these programs get implemented in a competitively neutral way. And there was a lot of discussion earlier about the impact of shopping and how that could affect the demand reduction targets required by Act 129. And I look forward to hopefully getting into that during the question and answer session. Thank you.
Next, we will have Mr. Kelleher from Direct Energy.
Thank you, Chairman Cawley, Vice Chairman Christie, and Honorable Commissioners. It's a pleasure to be here today. Given the briefness of the presentation, I'll not be walking through the actual PowerPoint, but I will let you know that I'll be referring to page 18 at some point. I actually want to get right into one of the issues that Commissioner Pizzengrilli raised, which is the issue of customer education, and use that as an example of what role suppliers can play in delivering energy efficiency services to Pennsylvania consumers. What you view as customer education, which is a critical barrier to the success of these programs, we actually view as marketing. And we do marketing as part of our typical business activities in a particular state. And so in some sense, we will provide for free, those of us who provide these services, and there are a number of us, we will offer for free what you will spend a lot of money, and I think some, obviously some education efforts through the utilities, through the PUC and other public entities is entirely appropriate, but you have a great opportunity to leverage what we are willing to do in the marketplace to improve the deliverability of these programs, and it is a significant barrier. New York is a great example. NYSERDA, which is the central administrator of their programs, they have great programs. Their main problem is finding customers who will take them. And for suppliers like Direct Energy, and I think I'm here sort of as an example, whereas Richie is talking about the more general, what we can do and what we offer is branding and scale. And I would use my own example in shopping for energy efficiency as an example to the particular kind of barrier that we can help you overcome. I live in the National Grid Service Territory in Massachusetts. I confess I am not from Pennsylvania. And we're a great, great candidate for one of their programs for home energy efficiency, especially insulation. Our house was built back in the 80s, and that would be the 1880s. And so we thought it could really help us. Well, I went to the website, and I punched through the various web pages to get to that particular insulation program, which provides a fantastic rebate up to 75%, up to $2,000. And what I ended up getting was a list of 30 contractors, none of whom I had ever heard of. It was just an Excel spreadsheet. I don't know what you do if you don't have a computer. I think what probably happens is that they just mail you the list. I called the three closest to the house. I got cell phone voicemail for all of them. I heard back from one. They came out. They gave a reasonable quote. I called them back. I was told it was an 8-week wait, and that's all I've heard from them since then. Now contrast that with a situation where I could call someone who is either already providing my electricity or natural gas service, or has marketed those services in my neighborhood, and with one phone call, I can arrange to have all of that work done without having to make any other phone calls, and it's somebody that I've heard of, and over time will build a brand and a scale presence in the neighborhood. And I do want to, and this is where I'll refer to page 18, the reason I think Direct Energy is a good example of the kind of company that can do that is that we already have a significant presence in this market in the United States, and we bracket Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact. We're one of the largest HVAC and plumbing installation and service platforms through our home services division. We've got 27 locations. The U.S. headquarters is in Dayton, Ohio. We have a significant presence in Maryland. The headquarters of our Direct Energy business services is in Pittsburgh. So we're poised to expand our presence in the Pennsylvania market, and we would welcome the opportunity to do so. And lastly, I want to provide you with an example of the kind of program that that this partnership, and it really is a partnership among the commission, the utilities, and a supplier like Direct Energy. We did this in Houston. It's called the REAP program, the Residential Energy Efficiency program. We worked with the City of Houston and CenterPoint, which is the utility. The City of Houston identified particular subdivisions that that would be most appropriate for energy efficiency measures. And this gets at some of the things that Secretary Hanger got at. For you know, you want to focus on where you're going to do the most good. They identified these neighborhoods by age of home, household size, household income, and the overall condition of the homes. And then it was turned over to us to go ahead and go into these neighborhoods and market aggressively and actually provide the services. And we had tremendous success. We achieved in those neighborhoods 60% penetration rate, which is practically unheard of, and an average of 19% savings for each one of those households. And the other thing I would say about that program, again,
30 seconds.
Thank you. Commissioner Hanger, and this is what I believe you with, made this point as well. Spend more on a fewer number of homes. That program, it was an unlimited amount. Well, it wasn't unlimited, but they would spend whatever it took in those homes to bring them up to appropriate standards, up to a $4,000 cap. And it's far more effective to go at a smaller number of buildings with a much more aggressive and ultimately effective program than to spread that over a larger number of homes with a lesser and possibly less effective incentive. And with that, I appreciate your time and would be happy to take any questions.
You have questions of Vice Chairman Christie?
Thank you. Mr. Hudson, thank you for your testimony. I might just have one area where I'll quibble with you in just a hair. You made the comment that competition and choice are critical towards successful demand-side management and conservation programs. While I don't doubt that having competition and choice may help accelerate some programs, if you just look historically at the co-ops and the municipalities, they've been doing these demand-side management programs and conservation programs for over 25 years, right here in our own state. They control 10% of their peak load with very simple, tried-and-true technologies such as water heater controls, air conditioner controls, dual-fuel heating control type of programs, compact fluorescent bulbs. So I think as long as there's a will and as long as there's leadership to make firm programs available to people, that this is not complicated. You don't per se need competition to make this happen. You just need to have dedication to going after these programs. And now, I don't doubt that having competition and choice may lead to some other innovative products that can help us get even beyond a 10% of a peak reduction. But that's what's been frustrating for me being here at the state for the last year and a half, is that you know they're simple programs. You know they can be done cost effectively. They've been implemented for the past 25 years. And so I hope we just keep that common sense and simplicity to the programs and get some good savings done at the end of the day.
Thank you. Commissioner Pallison?
Thank you. Mr. Hudson, thank you for your testimony here today. We heard earlier from Duquesne, you know, 90% of their C&I customers are shopping, 20% of their residential customers are also shopping. I think all of us agree we want to see a robust market here in 2011 in Pennsylvania. You alluded to Texas, and I did a little fact-finding in terms of getting on the Texas website and all the options that you have available as a customer. And I'd like you to maybe talk about what are some of the key drivers of the success that's taking place in the state of Texas.
That's an excellent question, and Texas really is probably an example of the most successful competitive retail market in regard to electricity and energy services in the country. And really, the single factor has been their market design. They have market responsive default service procurement product. When they actually had a default service type product that was called the price to beat in in 2007, the price to beat actually went away. So now it's actually the competitive supplier community that has the default service or provider of last resort obligation, not the utility. So, and that's an example of really moving towards an entire new paradigm in the way you can shop for electricity. As the chairman mentioned earlier, it's great that that Duquesne has sort of proven that you can successfully have the EDC in a role as a wires-only company, and that really is the model that's been adopted in Texas, and it's proven to be extremely successful.
And as a follow-up to that, you know, as we talk about the deployment of AMI here in the state and other technologies, I like to refer to it as we're taking a holistic approach to providing, I called it consumer-driven electricity. Ron, you corrected me. What did you call it again?
Consumer-driven energy.
Energy, okay. Your thoughts on, I'm a firm believer that you don't see that innovation in the marketplace unless you have what we've passed in Act 129 and, as a backdrop to that, a competitive, deregulated marketplace. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. The potential for the competitive market is really twofold. First, we think that there's a great role for the competitive marketplace to play in meeting the Act 129 requirements. And in that regard, there's a couple of steps that we think are really necessary to make sure that takes place. We think that the utility should engage in an open and transparent competitive solicitation process so that they are able to take a look at the entire universe of programs that are available. The idea of competitive procurement for these types of programs, people have different ideas for what that really means, and we think that means actually allowing third-party conservation service providers, whether it's an electric generation supplier like Reliant or Direct, that does energy efficiency and conservation services, or other more types of traditional conservation service providers that are involved in the weatherization or appliance upgrade space, that they have the ability to design the specific parameters of these programs and propose them to be included or considered in an EDC's Act 129 compliance plan. And then the second part of the second role that the competitive marketplace can play is in providing voluntary programs that are sort of outside of the immediate issue of meeting these Act 129 goals. And we think that having a successful marketplace for the retail electricity commodity will serve as a platform for allowing EGSs and other service providers to expand the types of innovative products and services that they want to bring to the marketplace. And the smart energy program that I discuss in my testimony that Reliant's considering is a perfect example of that.
Well, thank you for your leadership and testimony here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Pittson-Grilly.
Thank you. A question that could be answered by both of you. As you know, the Act requires a gradual deployment of smart meters over a 15-year period, and as you heard earlier today and we've read in some of the comments, you're recommending that they be deployed on a much more expedited basis. And what would that be? What would your recommendation be on that? And you also attached to your testimony recommendations for standards. Are those standards that you've seen in other areas being used, or are they coming from your organization?
Sure, thank you. That's a great question. And for the deployment schedule, we don't have a specific recommendation for the timeline for full mass market deployment. We certainly think that the sooner the better. But for example, if a conservation service provider were to propose a program, or if a utility were to propose a program to meet its Act 129 obligations, and that program was dependent on smart meter infrastructure, you know, we think that the cost of that smart energy infrastructure shouldn't be included in the total resource cost test, because Act 129 actually provides a separate standard for considering the cost and benefit of smart meters from the Act 129 program. So we think that there's a role for smart meters to play in meeting the Act 129 obligations. And in that regard, we'd encourage greater availability for the EDCs to deploy smart meters. And then to the second part of your question, the standards really are critical. It's important that we have certain minimum functionality standards in place so that we can bring all of these great products and services to market. And one that I'll touch on specifically is the importance of open and non-proprietary access to the meter and to the data that that the meter is capable of providing, and the communication platform that that the smart grid uses. It's important. It's sort of like the internet. If you have Comcast as your internet service provider, they really have no say with regard to how you use the internet. And we think a smart meter and smart grid should sort of be the same way. So an entity like a conservation service provider can directly control in-home devices and communicate with those in-home devices.
If I could just add to that, because I think it also goes back to the question that the Vice Chairman Christie asked. The open source issue is absolutely critical, because without it, what becomes the promise for the things that really get you where you want to go after you get, and I totally agree with you, Vice Chairman, that you have to get to those things that where the technology is already there, it's already well known, you have to go after that low-hanging, cost-effective fruit. It's not going to be enough in the long run to get you what you need. I think we're somewhere at the beginning of the break in the J curve. The rest of it is going to be technology based. Energy management is really what this whole business will become, I think, in the next 20 to 30 years. And if at the very beginning of that process, I think there's been a widespread agreement, and this sort of has resolved over the past 10 years, that the meter itself is probably appropriately thought of as a piece of distribution infrastructure, but the data and the data management system, the software part of it, it has to be open source, it has to be as much as possible consistent, not only among the service territories within a state, but increasingly where you have, and you're going to rely on, I think, companies that operate like Direct Energy does across multiple states. It needs to be really an open source system nationwide, and possibly even beyond that, because this will become a data management exercise. And the more you can do to facilitate the ease of that data management and the innovation that will come along with that at the beginning, it will pay off tremendously in the end.
Are there any other states that you're active in that you would recommend that we look at their standards?
I think Texas has some standards in place, and one of the standards is the open access, non-proprietary access, and Maryland, I believe, has adopted similar standards. We've sort of used both of those to develop the chart that's attached to my testimony, which goes into a little bit more of the technical details surrounding that, but a lot of these ideas are currently being vetted in other states.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you both for coming in this morning to present to us. My question is to both of you, but I think it's probably more geared towards Direct Energy. Do you have feet on the ground in Pennsylvania? Are you prepared to effectively market your services here in Pennsylvania now?
Right now, at this moment, as far as the home services, we do not. We are looking, obviously, at Pennsylvania is one of the most promising markets in the United States. As I say, we have locations that sort of bracket Pennsylvania and Ohio and Maryland, and certainly where the opportunity to present itself, and we think if done properly, there will be an opportunity here to act as a conservation service provider in partnership with the utility. I would say that would be very, very high on our list for immediate expansion of those services into Pennsylvania. I think we do have some ability now in certain parts of Pennsylvania to use, for example, our Maryland workforce to deliver services into certain parts of Pennsylvania, but not statewide.
Okay. The next question is a follow-on. And as you've heard earlier comments, there is a very steep penalty for non-compliance for the EDCs not to achieve their conservation and energy efficiency goals. Do you think that it would be appropriate for your member companies and Direct Energy to assume some of the risks that the EDCs are exposed to if you're going to propose working in their service territories?
If we were given some type of commensurate possibility of reward, and specifically the thing that jumps into my mind is if we were allowed some known customer base. I mean, that's sort of what's missing now is, we're still in the process, in many service territories this hasn't even begun yet because of the continuation of the rate caps, of building a customer base, where we don't have a customer base accepting that kind of risk would be problematical. Were we given the opportunity for some type of scale entry on the commodity side, we would certainly consider it. And I'll tell you what we would definitely do, 100% do, is we are more than willing and eager to enter into relationships, contractual relationships with the utility to deliver these services on a fixed amount basis, and those contracts would have, I'm sure, some type of penalty for not performing. So if you, and in fact, this is the kind of model that gets us to make that kind of business commitment to a particular service territory. If you say, out of that 1%, we want you to get X million kilowatt hours, and here's a contract that provides you with a guaranteed level of funding to do that, we would absolutely sign a contract like that with the even with penalties for, in fact, we would be shocked if there weren't penalties for non-performance there.
Any comment?
I would just echo what Chris has said, and the fact that the legislation imposes the obligation and the penalty on the EDCs should not be viewed as looking to the EDCs to be the provider of these programs. It's it's really quite simple through contractual arrangements. If a conservation service provider in EGS is selected to provide the programs, as Chris mentioned, you can contractually assign the non-compliance penalty fairly straightforward manner.
The point of the question was really to come to state to our listeners out there, as well as the EDCs that are in the room, that there are conservation service providers who are willing to share the risks on a contractual basis if it can be structured appropriately.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Chairman Cawley.
Mr. Hudson, in your testimony, you have given three examples of how the companies you represent can help us achieve our goals with this legislation. New pricing options and more efficient energy procurement strategies for customers. In other words, your companies will help customers purchase electricity more in a manner that they'll save money. Is that it?
Yeah, basically, yes.
Okay, that's the first one. Second is green and clean products. And the third is value-added services, which you describe as ranging from facilitating customer participation in RTO and ISO demand response programs. Now, that obviously are larger customers who are going to take advantage of the programs offered by the PJM interconnection, which would ship their load and what have you. So those are for larger customers. And maybe not so large, but mostly larger customer. And then comprehensive energy efficiency audits and upgrades. So your companies would audit buildings and suggest ways that buildings can be more energy efficient. All of that is great, but I've got to wonder to what extent we have participation by your companies, and including Direct Energy in Pennsylvania. Now, I'm aware that Direct Energy has a major office now in Pittsburgh. We are aware that Direct Energy, for instance, is providing service to residential and small commercial customers in the Pike County Light and Power Territory. We've seen residential and small commercial shopping in the Duquesne territory extensively and growing in the Penn Power territory. But when are we going to get the 70 to 90 electric generation suppliers to return to Pennsylvania after they fled when the wholesale prices got above the generation rate caps? When are your companies going to come back and provide these services to help us meet these goals?
That's an excellent question, and it sort of goes to another point that I addressed in my testimony, which is it's critical that the market structure be designed to facilitate entry by competitive suppliers. Default service procurement and pricing is the single most important factor that will decide whether EGSs are able to enter the market. If there's too much emphasis placed on long-term procurement, long-term contracts, it simply becomes too risky for an electric generation supplier to enter the market because it's not a sustainable market design. You can't buy high and sell low, which is the very problem that has led to EGSs fleeing the market after the initial restructuring period. So certainly as the electric generation rate caps roll off, you'll see enormous interest. I know both a prior employer that I worked for and the one that I'm working for now, Reliant, are already looking at market entry plans into the future. So our members are eyeing Pennsylvania as the next major opportunity. So your question of when, business climate is very dynamic, but as rate caps roll off in 2010 and 2011, I expect there will be enormous opportunities here for our companies.
Mr. Callahan, do you have anything to add to that?
I guess the best way to say it is that trying to be cognizant of the fact that there are open cases on the implementation of the other parts of Act 129. So I guess I would leave it at the implementation of those other sections, especially the procurement section, will have a significant impact on whether the resulting market structure will be one that will sustain the retail market. And we believe, obviously, that there are ways to implement those sections that will create a robust competitive market while fully meeting all the public policy goals of the Act, and we look forward to participating fully in the cases that will implement those sections of the Act.
And what did you mean by saying that we have to implement this in a competitively neutral manner then?
I think there are a couple of aspects of competitive neutrality. The one that you mentioned earlier is that the competitive procurement requirement that's embodied in Act 129 should be read to actually allow a wide range of program designs. So rather than have the utility specifically design the parameters of the program and the specific measures that they want to implement, we would like to see an open process where market participants can design those programs and have those programs considered in a cost-effective manner by the utility and by the commission. And then the second piece of that is as the programs are implemented, they should not be conditioned on the receipt of default service from the EDC. So if I want to choose Direct Energy as my electricity commodity provider and use Duquesne Light for a residential direct load control program, I should have that opportunity. It's maximum choice for the customer, and it's really a win-win proposition.
So if PECO, for instance, achieves its 1% goal by 2011 by programs which we've set the standards and they implement them, you're saying that electric generation suppliers and customer conservation service providers should be able to do additional measures or not be excluded, even though the utility doesn't get credit for what you achieve?
I think the utility should be able to get credit for what we've achieved if we've designed a program and proposed that program in the context of the utility's Act 129 implementation plan. So we would envision a process where the utilities would have retain an independent third-party entity to solicit a wide range of programs from interested conservation service providers, and that would take place before the utility submits its Act 129 compliance plan.
So that when they do submit it to us, we could insist that you be included. Actually, we could do that as a part of our mid-January requirements.
Yes, absolutely.
Or at least, you're saying at least leave the option open that they can use you to achieve part of their goals. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you both.
Okay. Thank you for having us.
We have reached the point in the agenda where there is a lunch break scheduled. I have 12 noon. We will adjourn or recess for half an hour and start promptly again at 12:30.